go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Ben Mullen.
And I'm Scott Benjamin.
Scott, I'm laughing because I totally botched this first intro. I don't know what I was going for. Some sort of Good Morning Vietnam thing?
It was kind of a rough start. I almost wish people would have a chance to hear it.
You know what? I'm sure I will embarrass myself enough on
maybe
this.
Maybe on the blooper reel.
You know what? Maybe we can consider the blooper reel a design innovation for our podcast. Maybe
Possibly.
We should have a blooper reel as part of our aesthetic style.
Plus, yeah, that's like a week off for us.
That is totally a week off for us.
Yeah, that's right. It would be hell for the editors, but it's a week off for us.
You know, it would be it might not be safe for work to be completely candid.
Let's consider it.
Let's consider it.
Yeah.
And while we're considering that, let's consider the topic of our podcast today.
And there's a lot to consider here because this guy is somebody that we've talked about in the past, but we did more of a kind of biographical piece on him.
Yeah, sort of a biopic, how he came to be, his origin story.
Exactly. Harley Earl and his design innovations. And in fact, we're going to talk about 11 design innovations that we've got highlighted in an article on our site. Of course, 11 design innovations of Harley Earl is the name of the article. If you want to follow along at home. But honestly, Ben, looking at this list, I mean, we'll just briefly talk about Harley himself. But one thing that struck me about this list when you first looked at it is that a lot of these items are still kind of hanging around in one way or another.
Oh yeah,
these are long lasting things. Now some have gone the way of the dodo bird; they're gone.
Yeah, and some are ubiquitous though now.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So I think let's get into this. But I think there's some surprises in here.
Now, as we get into this, just to get us started off, I'm going to go ahead and ask our fearless super producer Casey for some Harley Earl hero music. And there we go. All right. So just a real quick recap. We have the podcast on Harley Earl's origin story if you want to hear it. But this fellow comes to us from Los Angeles, California, 1893, Scott.
That is a long time ago. Now, here's the thing. He died in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
So he was 75 years old. He died in Florida. But his career goes all the way back to when he was really young. I mean, really young.
A whippersnapper.
He started working in his dad's shop, which was originally was a coach building shop that made horse and buggy coaches.
Yes.
And he started working there actually when it was already converted over to automobiles, the brand new automobile thing that was happening in America. You know.
Yeah, it's a fad.
Yeah.
If God intended us to ride in cars, he would have made us born in Ford Tauruses. I don't know.
Something like that. So he started to work as a what they still called a custom coach builder. Ooh. And because they were in Hollywood, they were producing cars for the Hollywood elite at the time. Ooh. So, you know, a lot of big celebrities came through his dad's shop for customization work.
The swells, the movie producers.
Exactly. Yeah. So his roots in, you know, the automotive industry go all the way back to when he was a youngster.
And one of his first design innovations that we have listed here, I think, is one of his most crucial contributions.
Yeah, and you know, you can't really get past this one without realizing that this is the guy that was the first head of design at GM. Mm-hmm. So imagine this, that before this time, engineers were designing cars.
Yeah.
You got to remember that, like, they just didn't have a section set aside for body styling or any type of color combinations or anything like that. It was strictly about how function, not so much as form, was important.
Yeah, let's call it utilitarian.
Exactly. Yeah, imagine an engineer designing a car, how it would look. It would be very, very functional.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be so pretty.
Right, and that's, of course, it's crucial to have, need it even be said, a functioning car.
Yeah.
But it distinguishes your vehicle in the marketplace, especially at this time.
Yeah, it was big for, at the time, it was big for General Motors. They started this division called the Art and Color Section,
mm-hmm.
Which they later named, was it Styling?
Just Styling.
Just simply Styling.
And now Styling is kind of a slang thing to say.
Yeah, it kind of is, yeah.
He's prescient.
I don't know exactly what it's called now. I mean, maybe it's still the Styling division, but but at the time it was called Art and Color. And, of course, I don't think he liked that all that much. So he decided that we'll call it Styling. But he was the first one to do that. You know, GM was the first one to do this, and he was the first head of design. So, again, right there at the very beginning, right at the head of all this.
And they created this position for him on his first day. Alfred Sloan, the GM chairman of the time, offered him this position directing the styling of all GM cars.
Yeah, can you imagine the feeling that you would have, if you were able to do something like that, because right then he's got a blank slate. I mean, where do you start? Because, everything you do is going to be innovative and new. So, he had great ideas, of course, but I think he had a wonderful opportunity as well.
Yes, exactly. You have to have both of those. The interesting thing about this first innovation is that it's difficult to estimate how fundamentally this changed the auto industry.
It's clear that, number one, it's Auto Styling Studio.
Right.
It was never around before this. Mm-mm. This is Harley's thing. He went to Sloan and said, what I think we need is this. And he sold the idea. It worked. And, now it's a huge part of the automotive industry. How are cars known? They're known by the way they look. They're not really known. I don't even know how to best describe this.
I think it depends sometimes on the model, but like the Honda Element or the Scion, often they're sold with these customization aesthetic packages.
True. Yeah. There's a look to every car. You can still if you're careful about it. If you really watch, a lot of cars are starting to look similar in shape. But I think you can still pick out individual makes and models of cars on the road. I actively do this in traffic. I sit and try to think. I name vehicles and makes and models if I can, and it just kind of keeps myself it's a way to keep myself fresh, to see if I can recognize that's a Honda, whatever, an Accord or Civic, and that's a Jaguar XJ.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt. Did you hear that little gasp I made earlier?
No.
Okay, so I had a gasp of surprise. I tried to keep it minimal. In an earlier listener mail, we had a writer named Matt who said that who wanted us to talk about the very thing you just said, the globalization of car design.
Oh, okay.
He said, it seems to me that cars around the globe are slowly but surely starting to look the same.
This has been going on for a long, long time, though. Think back to when Ford designed the new, at the time, Taurus. That was kind of one of the criticisms that, they're getting into this. I think they called it the jelly bean design. They called it the soap dish design.
Yeah,
something
I remember
like that. And
for
a while, a lot of cars did look very similar. And I think we're almost starting to get out of that now. There's less and less of that than there was. There are certain types of cars, like maybe four-door sedans, that have a similar roof line.
Mm-hmm.
I see this big arch. I don't know what better way to say it. I don't know all the terms. But you can see a lot of similar lines in, let's say, the Volkswagen CC and the new Mercedes. And, there's just a lot of cars that have that same arch across, from front to back, like from the front windshield to the back windshield.
Speaking of windshields.
Yeah. Dig me out of this hole.
Okay. Back. Speaking of windshields. I put you in that hole. I'm sorry. Speaking of windshields, one of the second innovations here, or the second innovation rather, there's no 2A, 2B, the wraparound windshield. Now, this first comes in a 1951 concept car.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what the wraparound windshield idea is. The glass curves sharply at the ends to meet the windshield pillars.
Mm-hmm.
So this gives it kind of a panoramic view at the time in the 1950s, a super futuristic look.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that maybe people in our generations would look back on and think this was very retro, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I guess so. We have a mild version of this now. Glass is not flat.
No.
Most glass is not flat. You look at it like a Jeep Jeep Wrangler or something, you know, from, I don't know, the 1990s or whenever, you know, before that, it was still flat.
Right.
Mostly. But now, you know, most windshields have a pretty good curve to them. Nothing, though, however, like the like these old Cadillacs, like the 53 Cadillac that they're talking about.
Yeah, the Eldorado.
That, I mean, if you want to see a curve, a dramatically curved windshield, take a look at that. They're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has a significant bend in the front so that you can see to the left or right in front of the A-pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a big innovation because before that, you know, a lot of times if it wasn't flat, if it was, you know, mildly curved,
sure,
it would be two segments of glass that were joined in the middle with a strut of some kind. And you probably can think of examples of that you've seen, you know, like with a metal bar in between two mm-hmm. flat pieces that come together to form a, you know, an angle in front. That was not common, but, you know, it was there.
It happened.
Yeah, it happened. A lot of times it was just a flat piece of glass. You know, Model T's had flat pieces of glass like that. I don't know about Model A's, I'm trying to think. But, you know, going way back, that's how they handled it. And before that, there wasn't even a windshield.
Yeah.
So this curving the glass and giving it, I don't know, it really does help the styling a lot. I mean, take a look at one with a dramatically curved piece of glass like this, and you'll see what he's talking about.
Here, two things. Here's a fairly good comparison. I'll phrase it as a question. Scott, is Harley Earl the Steve Jobs of the auto industry?
You know what? That's not a bad way to say it. Yeah.
I'm interested to see what other people think about this.
Constant innovation.
Yeah. Second thing, model line hierarchy. This is number three on the list. Mm-hmm. And when you said models, it brought it to my mind. Crazy story, folks. Cars were not always sold with a hierarchy of increasing price and status.
Yeah, yeah. And the example that they give, of course, is General Motors. And,
yes.
You know, the idea that, you know, you would sell these vehicles in this order. You would say, like, okay, there's a pecking order in mm-hmm. our field here, and our
yeah.
and especially in our company itself, not just within, you know, the you know, making cars, but
right.
making cars at GM.
The days of just black Model A's are gone.
Exactly. So the pecking order at the time and levels of prestige went from lowest to highest,
mm-hmm.
and it was listed as this. Hey, do you want to read them?
Yeah, starting at the bottom, you got the Chevrolet. That's your starter car.
Mm-hmm.
We'll switch off.
Pontiacs were next.
And then the Oldsmobiles. I have one of those. I'm proud of myself.
Moved up to the big Buicks.
And then, of course, the Cadillac.
Yeah, exactly. So Cadillac was the top end. Chevy was the low end. And in between, you know, you had three others that,
mm-hmm.
you know, they progressively stepped up in prestige and styling and features and options and comfort items. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so the thing is, like, you still want to make them attractive. You know, you want to make the Chevrolets attractive. So,
right.
you know, he designed them to be attractive and designed them to you know, be functional, of course. But when you get up to the level of, like, let's say the Buicks and the Cadillacs,
mm-hmm.
you start getting all of these really fancy options and really, you know, you get maybe a lot of chrome and you get
right.
The styling that really stands out from everything else on the road. And that's where I think a lot of the time was spent was you know, into the Buicks and the Cadillacs
mm-hmm.
of the day.
Yeah,
but
kidding.
I mean, it's hard to believe, but I mean, this wasn't around until, you know, until Harley Earl was in position.
That's crazy.
I just don't understand. I mean, it's tough to think back, like, before that maybe the Cadillacs didn't have any more weight at GM than the Chevrolets did
mm-hmm.
or the Pontiacs did. I'm sure that there was a cost difference, probably.
Yeah,
maybe minimal. I'm not exactly sure. I would have to look back at the data and find out, you know, exactly how much a new Cadillac cost versus a new Pontiac of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when Harley Earl came in and the styling and this hierarchy pattern began, that's when you really started to see a dramatic difference in cost.
And that's kind of when Cadillacs became the flagship.
Yeah, like the Cadillac of automobiles.
Yeah. Yeah, they became the Cadillac of... We are knocking it out with comparisons today. They became sort of a dream car, but not the dream car concept, because mm-hmm. coming in at number four on our list is the concept car, which Harley Earl referred to as the dream car.
Yeah, again, unbelievable. It's hard to believe that this didn't exist until the 30s because, you know, we've been making cars, you know, from the late 1800s to this point. But this is an idea that's still very popular today, the concept car.
Yeah, yeah. Now, maybe I'm nitpicking a little bit when I say that there were other one-off non-production vehicles. I mean, that's essentially a concept car. There were plenty because there were custom coach builders beforehand.
That's the thing. There were a lot of custom vehicles. There were a lot of one-off cars, and they would show cars. But this dream car idea that he had, this is like, you know, we're taking it to the show. We're going to put every option that we can think about on it. We're going to style it the way we want to. It's going to be dramatic. It's going to be incredible.
Yeah.
And we're going to see how people react to it.
And that's what makes it a brilliant move. That's what makes it so smart. Because why risk so much money? We've talked before about how expensive and risky it is to engage a market with a new vehicle.
Yeah.
It's so much smarter to just build one, make it fantastic.
Yeah.
So this superior.
So this Buick Y-Job, this 1938 Buick Y-Job, was the first what they called dream car.
Uh-huh.
And like you said, it's a lot cheaper. I mean, it still costs a lot of money to build a concept car, I'll tell you that. But it's a lot cheaper than launching a full line of automobiles that you then have to sell throughout the entire year before you can make another change.
Or not sell.
Well, that's probably the more likely scenario.
And we've talked about concept cars before in the show. We really enjoy these ideas. You see some tremendously innovative engineering. Mm-hmm. You see, frankly, some stinkers. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a matter of opinion, but I've seen some concept cars that I wouldn't particularly drive.
We've talked about some really bad ones.
Right, and not all concept cars, a lot of concept cars, in fact, never make it to production, but still the expense saved there, then the market research you can do. It's amazing that no one had thought of this before.
Yeah, you know something else that saves quite a bit of money?
What's that?
Clay modeling. And that is number 5 on the list.
Yeah.
Clay modeling. Now, prior to clay modeling, which seems, you know, everybody has heard or has seen this happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's on commercials. You know, it's something that the industry continues to tout in that they make these clay models. Even with, you know, the latest computer design assistance that they have. They still do clay models, Ben. Mm-hmm. It's still something that they hand form cars. They use machines to form vehicles. Later, I want to do a whole program about what I learned at Ford while I was there in their design studio. But they've got an incredible system to create clay models, though. It does still create a clay model. Now, all this technology goes right back to, you know, these guys working with, you know, these hand tools that they've made themselves.
Wow.
So it's amazing. It's a great system.
What did they do beforehand?
Beforehand, they made steel models. They made full-out vehicle. Mm-hmm. They would make a car that was made out of steel. And can you imagine, to make a change on a steel model, how difficult that was compared to just, you know, I guess plunking another pound or two of clay on the fender and then reforming it to however you wanted it.
Yeah.
You had to take that fender off and then reform it. You know, roll it through, you know, whatever, the English wheels or whatever they would do, hammer it on an anvil. I'm not kidding. That's how they did it.
I mean,
it was a difficult process. And this, you know, just sped the process up significantly.
Wouldn't it be cool to have one of those models, those steel ones?
I would love to have that. I would love to have a clay model.
Yeah, no
anything.
Kidding.
Any of those models that they have, it would be fantastic to have. And a lot of times they make the rounds at the shows as well, you know, like the small-scale models. But, yeah, can you imagine having a steel model from, the 1920s or something from, you know, let's say Chevrolet?
I would never shut up about it.
Oh, yeah, that would be so cool, wouldn't it?
I mean, I would probably be like one of those people who's just had a baby and tries to work the baby into every conversation.
You'd somehow make it the centerpiece of your living room, right?
Yeah, I would. I might carry it around with me on a backpack, depending on how heavy it is.
Wow!
And then always look surprised that someone mentions it.
Oh, this I.
Oh, this. Yeah. This thing.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, it is priceless. let's talk about something that is a purely aesthetic, a flourish, if you will.
Yeah.
Those are the Dagmars.
Yeah, Ben. You know what? I was thinking about this earlier. Now, I looked up who this is patterned after.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dagmars, if you're not familiar with the term, I guess we could just...
Oh, yeah, we do.
Let's do this in a PG manner. How about
that? Okay, let's keep it PG.
PG, and the way that it's described here in the article is that these are protrusions, which were nicknamed Dagmars after a buxom TV personality of the day. So you can kind of get what we're talking about here, right?
And on the off chance that you don't...
Yeah.
It's on the internet. You can check it out. I'm sure your Google Foo is good enough.
Yeah.
that you can work down.
So
it'll be
Dagmar was actually the stage name for a woman named Virginia Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Lewis, that was her stage name. And again, buxom TV personality today. So you get the idea of what we're talking about here. If you don't, take a look at the 1950s Cadillacs and look at the chrome protrusions that stick out from the bumper, and you'll get the idea pretty quick.
And these things do also serve a function. They are bumper guards.
Oh.
So they actually...
Oh, the bumpers.
Oh, man. Okay, so yes, the bumpers. They do serve a purpose.
You didn't really think we were going to get through this without having some kind of discussion.
I wondered about this one.
Okay, let's move on. We're both turning bright red here.
Chevy Corvette.
Oh, yes. You know what? This is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how happy I am that that Earl came up with this, or that this was his the progression of design. You know, it came from he let's see. How do you want to go about this? Because we can go back to the LeSabre show car if you want.
Okay.
You know, the LeSabre show car is that car that was just this outrageous design. It was a fantastic looking car, in my opinion.
And it was his baby.
He drove it everywhere. He drove it to work every day, put something like, 50,000 miles on the car, 45,000 miles.
We're
talking about the early 50s.
Right. He drove the LeSabre to a sport car race in New York.
Yeah, he shows up in this concept car that is his daily driver. How cool is that to begin with? And not only that, Ben, this is Harley Earl. I mean, everybody knows who this guy is at this point because, we've gone from the point where he was hired by Sloan, way back when, there wasn't even an auto style in the studio.
Right.
And now here's Harley Earl showing up at your race on the weekend in this LeSabre show car, which had made the rounds to all the shows, had been popular, been on magazine covers, had been probably in the newspapers, I would think.
And then he just cruises by like a regular Joe Schmo.
Awesome. This must have been awesome.
This is super cool.
He shows up, realizes that a lot of these guys are racing cars at this this weekend race that are imports.
Yes.
And people like these small, fast, sporty cars. And guess what? GM didn't have one at the time.
Yeah.
They didn't really have a car that fit that bill at the time. So he said, let's get to work on this. We need to do something that's going to be comparable, something that's going to sell to these types of guys. These guys that are very passionate about their cars and not only something they can drive on the track, but something they can drive on the street every day.
And he made this decision in 1951. And when did the Corvette debut?
1953, which is...
Boom.
Darn quick.
This guy does not play around.
That was quick. Now, I mean, I know that the turnaround time recently has been a little faster. It's a shorter ramp-up time.
Yeah.
Back then, 2 years for something like this to develop a sports car from nothing, a ground-up sports car, amazing. Amazing. They must have worked around the clock, I would think, for those 2 years to get this done.
Maybe they didn't have to make steel models.
And, that's probably true.
Yeah.
I mean, they're up to, the seventh generation of Corvette? The sixth generation right now. The seventh generation is on its way in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that obviously is still around. My personal favorite, Ben?
What's that?
The second generation. I like the 63 to 67 design, the ones that Bill Mitchell, Larry Shinoda... the Mako Shark car, those
right.
concept
yeah,
cars.
Yeah, yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
The Stingray concept, that era, that was my favorite. I've got to say, the C2 Corvettes are my favorite.
Is it because of the Dagmars?
No, although I'm a big fan.
All right, so we got integrated body design next, number 8. So let's talk about this.
Please.
All right, so... This is sort of a – think of this as a harmonization of design. That's probably one of the best ways to put it.
Okay.
Because beforehand, cars were sort of Frankensteined together from the parts that were around.
Back to the engineering.
And again, as a fan of engineers, if it works, it works. And that's a primary focus. And what Harley Earl is basically doing here is he says, let's make – all of the pieces of the vehicle sort of more than the sum of their parts so that they are all, to be honest.
Let's make it fit,
yeah.
Yeah, which is it's a crazy thing to think about now because, fit and finish is something that's so important now. A lot of people buy a car based on fit and finish.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of craftsmanship and putting the thing together. And honestly, Prior to Harley Earl being there, it just wasn't there.
Yeah.
They had a bin of headlights, and you're going to use those headlights for every vehicle that we make. Mm-hmm. That's not the case with, you know, when Harley Earl was there. He's like, we're gonna have headlights for the, you know, for this vehicle. That may be a bad example, but right. something like that. Let's say that, you know, we're gonna make this part work on this vehicle, no mm-hmm. matter what it takes. He said, actually, let's design the piece around the vehicle as a whole.
Yes.
If that's maybe the way to say it.
Let's not force the puzzle pieces together.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then we've got something that I'm a big fan of, and it's sort of a regret of mine so far. Maybe I'm too young to have some serious regrets yet, but it's sort of a regret that I have not yet owned a car with tail fins.
Oh, it's never
Number
too late.
Number nine.
Ben. Never too late.
I should just put some on the
you
Monte Carlo, huh?
You know, I've been talking about, like, the last several episodes I've been mentioning old
yep.
Cadillacs that I've been kind of scoping out. And this is right in the prime of the tail fin era. And I don't think that's really what's attracting me to it. I'm not really sure exactly what's attracting me to these old Cadillacs, but something recently is drawing me to them.
Now, these things are, tail fins are pretty much ornamental.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, these are something that, you know, just a styling cue that he decided that he liked when he was looking at a jet, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was looking at a Lockheed P-38 Lightning. And decided that the twin boom tail of that particular jet, that uh-huh. Airplane, was something that he decided would look good on an automobile.
Yeah,
and I kind of like this. I like that he's taking styling cues from, you know, another whole segment of transportation and bringing it into automobiles.
Absolutely,
I like that.
He took it too far, though. I think.
Really?
Well, this is just my opinion. This mm-hmm. is just my opinion. But as I think we mentioned in the article. The tail fins on the 1959 Cadillac?
Yeah.
Ooh, I don't know, man.
Well, they're awful pointy.
I'm just saying. You know, this is subjective because at this point, it is an opinion thing. So
yeah.
they're just a little much.
They first showed up in 1948 on a Cadillac.
Right.
And it wasn't until, boy, Ben, they lasted until like the mid-1960s when they finally went away. Mm. But you think of like the 57 Chevrolet. That's one that's classic with the big tail fins.
Yeah.
The Cadillacs, of course, the Cadillac tail fins went sky high. They went way up, and they had, you know, they were very ornamental.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, some of them were really beautiful.
Yes, I agree with that. I want some tail fins, not too much. You know what I should do is I should just Photoshop a picture of the Monte Carlo with tail fins and see how I like it.
That might not be a bad idea.
Maybe a clay
model. I am positive. I know for sure that if you took that car to a local body shop and asked them to create custom tail fins on your vehicle, they would do it.
Yeah, maybe they would roll their eyes, but they would do
10
it.
10 pounds of Bondo, but they would do it. It could be done.
They would probably also be able to at least tell me how to get some more chrome on my vehicle.
Yeah, exactly. And that is number 10 on our list, Ben. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of chrome. Now, you know, there's criticism towards the end of the 1950s that maybe he had gone overboard.
Maybe they looked gaudy.
Yeah, that you know, Harley decided that, you know, he liked to add what they call visual pizzazz in the article here, and I like the way that's put, that it added a little something to the cars that just wasn't there before. I mean, he used it in a way that other people, you know, chrome had been used on cars before, of course.
Right.
But he used it in a way to advance, like to draw the eye in, or to maybe divert the eye in another way. I mean, he used it in a styling manner that no one else did.
To sort of lead the gaze,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, exactly. And it led to the overall feel of the vehicle. It got to the point where it got to be too much. And that was sometime in the late 1950s, believe it or not. I mean, you'd think it would have gone into the 1960s, because I know there are a lot of cars with lots of chrome still in the 1960s. But
right.
But by 1958 is what's pointed out specifically in this article. That's when they think that there was just too much what they call bright work, and that's chrome.
Yeah. Is anybody else noticing a pattern here? We got the tail fins, the chrome, the Dagmars. There's this ambition in his design where he says, okay, I've got this good idea. I'm going to see how far I can take it.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to start to scale it back if I go too far.
Yep.
I like that.
And
more and more of this. Yeah, more and more worked. We're on to my very favorite one.
Really?
The very last one. This is my favorite.
This is your favorite one.
Absolutely.
Really. All right. Well, this is something that I think a lot of people will be shocked. Now, this is the final one on our list here, number 11.
Yeah.
In 1956, there was a show car called the Buick Centurion, and the Buick Centurion didn't have rear-view mirrors, Ben.
No, it did not.
Had
I get to say it? Awesome. It had rear-mounted television cameras.
Yeah.
In 1950, what, six?
1956.
That's crazy.
Rear-mounted cameras in 1956 that would display onto a screen in the dash, in the center console.
Yes.
Now, that's incredible to me because that's we're talking a good 45 years before we really started to see it come back again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just made an appearance in this. Well, I guess it would be called a dream car.
Yeah,
in the 1950s,
clearly. Yeah,
probably.
It's a concept car.
So, you know, this came back in the early 2000s, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
We started to see some of the SUVs and the vehicles that, you know, you absolutely couldn't see behind because they became so big. Remember, there was a problem, you know, like you couldn't see kids or things
or
pets or anything behind you. You know, you couldn't see another car behind you.
The neighborhood bicycle, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So this is not a new idea. I think a lot of people are shocked that it's not a new idea, but it does come from the mid-1950s. And again, who was the head of design? Harlan Earl.
So if you want to be one of those, I guess the word would be an automotive hipster with your friends, and they're bragging about their rear-mounted television camera, their rear-view mirror camera, then you can say, you know, I really liked it better on the Buick Centurion. In 1956.
And then take a sip of your coffee.
And then take a sip. Well, it'll be a latte, right?
Of course.
I'm kidding. Don't do that, you guys. Don't be. That's insufferable,
yeah.
Right? That's cool.
It's over the top.
But it is a really cool fact to tell someone. Just don't act like, don't be condescending about it.
Yeah.
Because I kind of lost it just for a second when I read this part because I had no idea that this technology dated back so far, because often when we talk about innovations that make it to modern day models, right, they tend to come from a couple of places. They come from racing quite often. They might come from the military, and to see something like this come from a guy who was just really, really good at this.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see this sort of technology not really hit, then you have to ask yourself, what happened?
What happened in those 45 years in between? Why wasn't this a good idea any time in between now, then and now?
I bet it was expensive.
You know, he was, as they point out, he was a gadget guy.
Yeah.
And which I think is kind of neat. I mean, that, you know, of course he was. I mean, he was looking at the latest and greatest of everything, and he was on the forefront of that. A lot of times he was just sitting somewhere trying to dream up ideas of what we can add in. Here you go, cameras.
Yeah, and so I haven't done the deeper research that I want to do to explain this sort of gap in implementation. But if I'm just speculating, mm-hmm. don't quote me on this, mm-hmm. If I'm just speculating, I would imagine it has to have something to do with the cost of cameras at that time.
Oh, absolutely.
So
I would think it'd have to.
Versus a pane of mirror, you know?
Yeah.
So... So these are 11 of the design innovations, only 11 out of many. I don't know why I'm shaking my finger in the air.
There were many, many, many more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure that some of them are still around as well. These just happen to be the 11 that are on our list. But, you know, dig deeper into the life of Harley Earl and find out what he was all about. You know, we've got that podcast from a long time ago. If you go back to our list of, you know, historical podcasts, I suppose.
Right.
And do a search for Harley Earl, it'll come up. And that's an entire episode dedicated to just the man himself.
Wherein we mention a lot of the design innovations that are not on this list.
Yeah, yeah, and a few that are on the list.
So
you may hear a couple of repeats, but you know what? It's told in a different way. So there you
mm-hmm.
go.
So did you see anything interesting?
All right, you know, Ben, here's the thing. The other day, not the other day, I guess it was a couple weeks at this point, but I did see something unusual. And I thought, I got to write this down. I had no opportunity to take a photo like I have in the past, so there's no real image to go along with this. But you can imagine when I tell you. Okay?
I'll take your word for it.
So I'm leaving my home, leaving the neighborhood, and driving down the road, and headed the opposite direction is a Saturn, an older Saturn, like a sedan.
Mm-hmm.
And it caught my eye quickly, but I thought this was so absurd when I saw it. The Saturn had a roof scoop.
What?
A roof scoop.
Why?
Well, that's my point. Like, this is like, now I thought this was like a roof scoop to nowhere, right?
Okay
that's what I call it. I've written it down here as a roof scoop to nowhere, as Stuff Scott sees.
Okay.
But It could be functional, but I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason that it could be functional is that rally cars sometimes have roof scoops. And they are
okay.
functional. There's a
You're
purpose
right.
behind
You're
them,
right.
and I'll tell you about that in a second, but I doubt this is one of them.
Okay.
Just because of some of the other absurd things that were bolted onto this Saturn.
It wasn't just a roof scoop.
No, it had some really kind of funky aerodynamic stuff that was bolted onto it, and I didn't really get a good inventory of what was there, but I do know that this car was not a typical Saturn. It was not a rally car, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason for a roof scoop to be there to cool like a mid-mounted engine or something
sure.
like, you know, like let's say Lotus Elise or something like that, has,
right, okay.
or a Siege. They have a roof scoop that's functional. It brings air into the engine behind the driver. Makes sense, right?
Makes sense.
Okay, this one, if it was functional at all, would be open to the cockpit area of the car. So it would increase air pressure in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
This is why it's important to rally cars. It would increase air pressure in the cabin. It blows out dust. It keeps dust and things like that from being in, you know, from coming inside the car, and it allows hot air to escape as well. And it's very functional in a rally car, not so functional on a street car. And
yeah.
I'm almost thinking, because I looked this up afterwards,
okay.
and I was really intrigued by this. It was kind of funny because I was laughing about it on the way in.
To look it up to see if this was one of a kind or if
yeah,
other
like
people
what,
had done
like,
this?
You know, what kind of thing is this? Because you don't see many cars with roof scoop. So I looked it up, and it's like about a $200 to $300 option. And this one was painted, you know, to match the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So they spent some time getting this one to match. I just don't see it as being a functional add-on thing. I'm guessing that it was either, you know, solid, so there's no airflow going through this thing.
Right.
But in all likelihood, this is an aerodynamic thing or an add-on that actually hurts miles per gallon and increases, you know, the wind resistance.
Yeah, not to be a negative guy, but I think you might be right on that.
I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of the stuff, you know, that happened, you know, it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. So I know there's a lot of, you know, nonsense add-ons out there.
Sure.
You know, some that you know, kind of look cool, others that don't.
Right, like the big chrome pipes that don't actually do anything.
Yeah, some that fit well with the vehicle, some that don't fit well with the vehicle at all. And I was thinking, Ben, we've got this Facebook page.
Yes.
And I was thinking, all right, you know, here's the roof scoop to nowhere on the Saturn, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
What else have people seen out there that, you know, are ridiculous add-ons that they could maybe send in a photo to our Facebook page?
Great idea.
Or something that, you know, they've seen that, you know, was so poorly done that it's laughable, or something that's really well done that, you know, you think, like, that's not bad. You know, this actually does work. It's functional. That would be kind of cool, too.
Yeah, I want to see some of those ridiculous spoilers.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've seen some even made out of 2x4s or something goofy like that.
Oh,
so,
man. Yeah. This is a great idea.
What's out there? I mean, there's a ton of stuff. I mean, you guys are all over the world.
Uh-huh.
Send us in some photographs. Just take a quick photo with your cell phone or, you know, whatever you happen to have. Send it into our Facebook page and, you know, see what people think and, you know, just tell us what you think about it.
Yes, and bonus points if it's related to a car horror story. Because as we said in an earlier podcast, Halloween is coming up, and we'd love to do a Halloween episode with some car horror stories, preferably from listeners. But yes, send us your pictures via Facebook or Twitter. We want to see some add-ons that you think are maybe ridiculous, some add-ons you think are fantastic. We want to see the whole range. You can also send them to us directly in an email. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
Hey, Scott, one more thing before we head out.
What do you got?
Movie club.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, so...
You got a pick for us?
Yeah, I've got a pick this time. The Gumball Rally. You ever heard of this one?
I have heard of it, but I have never seen that one.
Dude, 1976, some vintage Gary Busey, several groups racing for a prize in a no-holds-bar cross-country thing. It's sort of a precursor to a Cannonball Run series.
You had me in 1976. but the thing is, Ben, I love the Cannonball Run series.
Mm-hmm.
They're just funny, goofy movies. Love them. But if this predates that and it's a similar idea, I'm going to like this one.
Yeah, and we hope our listeners like it too. If you guys want to check this out on Netflix and you're like, but wait, guys, I don't have an account. Well, no worries. You can get a 30-day trial by going to netflix.com/carstuff. let them know we sent you. And the last thing we should say is the titles are subject to availability, but the Gumball Rally is on there now, so check it out.
Yeah, we checked it. It's there.
Yeah, we totally checked it. It is there. And even more importantly, let us know what movies you are watching when you want to see a good car movie or something with a car chase, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a ton of those out there, and we love to see them. So send in your suggestions.
Ooh. And next episode, we'll go check out some car chase movies.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.